Hello everybody, can you hear me well? Good. Thank you for our speakers, and thank you for inviting me here and giving me the opportunity to speak here. My name is Shadi Rohana. I'm a Palestinian from Haifa, and I'm here on behalf of the Alternative Information Center in Jerusalem and Beit Sahur. The AIC is a joint Palestinian-Israeli organization which started in the mid-80s. And now we have an office in West Jerusalem and an office in Beit Sahur in the West Bank. And through our work, we try to provide some sort of a model for what kind of partnership we can actually have in Palestine, what kind of Arab-Jewish partnership we can have in struggle, and to insist that it is a partnership of struggle, of rights, for the Palestinians who are the colonized in this situation. And I just have one little comment about what was just said about what is, we receive a lot of critiques, the Palestinian society, of being undemocratic, about the issue of queer people, of course, about the issue of women. And I just want to stress right from the beginning that this is why we are fighting for our independence. We are fighting to be given the chance to actually make decisions regarding these issues. If we can be democratic, if women can be equal, if queer people can be equal and have the rights in Palestinian society now, then why are we fighting for our independence and for our own state? We are fighting exactly because of these reasons. Now to talk about the I'm going to focus on the BDS campaign so far that's been happening. Even though it is commonly known that the boycott campaign commenced this decade and only a few years ago, it is very important to note that the basic strategy of the campaign dates much earlier, to the early days of the Zionist colonization of Palestine. I once had the chance to look at an edition of a Palestinian newspaper called Falestine, which used to come out in Yaffa. And there is a note read from 14th of April 1929, in which the editorial calls for boycotting all Zionist products. And it labels such strategy to be our legitimate and nonviolent method to combat Zionism. And such as in 1929 and such as today, the basic premise is that the boycott is of Zionism and of Zionist products, considering them to be representing a colonial entity. We are talking back then in 1929 when Jews were a minority in Palestine. But despite that, the call for boycotting that Zionism in Palestine was not similar in any way to the call for boycotting the Jews in Europe. And this should be very clear. It was clear for Palestinians right from the outset what role the Jewish community in Palestine was playing, what role Zionism is playing in Palestine, and the call was for boycotting this, exactly this, not of boycotting the Jews, this was the call, similar calls for Germany and in Europe, which eventually led to the Holocaust. So the 1929 call, in fact, does echo the Palestinian call for boycott, disinvestment, and sanctions against Israel, which was released on the first anniversary of the International Court of Justice advisory opinion on the legality of Israel's construction of the separation wall in the occupied part of Palestine, which is today known as the West Bank. Now, we are, of course, speaking of two different times and two different realities. While in 1929, we Palestinians were right at our initial stages of imagining ourselves as a distinct nationality in a continuous space, and beginning to be fully aware of the threat that what was back then the Jewish minority in Palestine poses to our national aspirations for self-determination. What is different today is we are fully conceived as a nation by ourselves and also by our colonizer. Just to remind you that only 40 years ago, Golda Meir, who was back then the president of the prime minister of Israel, said that Palestinian people do not exist. And I would give another anecdote about this, about the difference of the development of this. Back in the 60s, when it was very difficult for Palestinian citizens of Israel to register at Israeli universities and start at Israeli universities, One of the only Palestinian students at the Haifa University, a Palestinian from Akka, the city of Akka, north of Haifa, during a political science class or history class, actually stated in class that I am a Palestinian. And we're talking about the 60s. And when she stated that I am a Palestinian, her statement made it to the front page of major Israeli newspapers. Today, there is no questioning about my identity and who am I. So we are talking about the time when this sort of development that took place, it was time when people, their own identity was denied inside Israel. And of course, here I would like to quote actually Rodolfo Walsh, the Argentine journalist and martyr who was killed by the military junta in Argentina. And referring to Golda Meir's statement that the Palestinian people do not exist, he said that each time the colonizer uttered such words about the colonized, there was a river of blood. And I think this is true for many cases in Latin America, in Africa, where people refuse to consider those who are fighting for their independence and for the struggle as a people with their own national aspirations. Now today, after continuous decades of sacrifice and suffering, which have culminated into a Palestinian reality, which is characterized by the following. One, the physical fragmentation and separation caused by the military occupation to Palestinians 48, Palestinians in the West Bank, Palestinians in the Gaza Strip, Palestinians in East Jerusalem, which maybe later we can speak more about it, and how these different sort of components of the Palestinian reality were formed and were constructed. Two, the actual geographical space, which is Palestine, and when I say Palestine right now, I'm meaning the West Bank, the Gaza Strip, what is now the state of Israel. Now this geographical space, Israel is destroying the land base for Palestinian self-determination by means of the separation wall, the colonies, and the terrorist blockades and imprisonment of more than 1 million people in the Gaza Strip. For me, I hold an Israeli citizenship. According to Israeli law, I'm just one of 1 million Palestinians inside Israel who hold Israeli citizenships. According to this Israeli law, we are not allowed to go visit our Palestinians, brothers and sisters in the West Bank and the Gaza Strip, of course. In my case, I do not have family in the West Bank, but for many other people, this means their own brother and sister, their own cousins, their own friends, people that they grew up with. Now the current reality is preventing that from happening at all. And of course, there is the case of Gaza, where you have more than 1 million people under a terrorist blockade. These people cannot go out. I definitely cannot go in, and all other Palestinians cannot go in. And then we have the Palestinian refugees who are in the Arab countries, and Israel prevents any Palestinian, whether you hold an Israeli ID or not, to actually leave the country and go to the Arab countries, because Israel still considers them to be enemy countries. And three, there is the nature of the humanitarian and development aid, which accommodates the facts on the ground that are Israel's colonial enterprise. Here I want to quote a Swedish aid worker, which appears in one of the ISC booklets, which I think we have on the table outside here, who have said, we have created the cheapest occupation. We support Israel with our money and our silence. And just to give something from my personal experience, I was once riding a bus from Jerusalem to the city of Bethlehem, which I was supposed to enter illegally, of course, for the Israelis. And the road that leads to the city, which is an uphill road, known as the Talita Road. And right at the entrance, it's a road that's used only by Palestinians. And right at the entrance, you see the big sign saying, "From the American people," which is, of course, of the US aid. And I remember while being at the bus, I was listening to a conversation of two old Palestinians who probably could not read the sign and could not read English, saying about how those Israelis, they try to make themselves look better for us, and they try to show us as if they are trying to make our lives more easier by constructing this road, and while they are building checkpoints, while they are preventing us from going to Jerusalem, where they are, and so forth. But just the reason that came to my mind, the first thing, and I actually argued that with them, is that Israel does not have to do anything for the Palestinians right now. What the role that the UN agencies are playing, the different corporations are, it's sort of a catch-22 sort of thing. It is, on the one hand, you cannot ask for aid to stop the Palestinians, but this aid is in fact accommodating the occupation. It's making Israel much more comfortable to occupy the Palestinians. They don't have to build roads, they don't have to provide any services anymore. And whoever should have, who has this responsibility, is basically the international agencies and now the Palestinian Authority. So now another characteristic of the current Palestinian reality is the insufficiency of the Palestinian leadership that is tied by political and economic agreements and diplomacy in order to seemingly provide effective support and a political perspective. I'm of course referring to the current Fatah-Hamas conflict and the insufficiency of the PLO and the Palestinian Authority right now to provide any political perspective. The inadequacy of the Palestinian leadership today, which echoes that of the aristocratic and fragmented leadership back in 1929, is to be seen in light of the decline of the effectiveness of the boycott policies of the Arab states, as several Arab governments since the 1970s and the 1980s began to explicitly and one-sidedly smooth cultural and political realities with Israel, relations with Israel, as a prelude for fully normal relations with Israel, which is today known as normalization with the Israeli state. if we look more at the history of Arab boycott of the state of Israel or of Zionism, so we have one actually before the it began before 1948. We have in 1945 the recently established Arab League actually called for adopted resolutions stipulating the need for Arabs to boycott products of Jewish settlements in Palestine. And we're talking about 1945 when the Arab League was recently established, but. To sort of explain the inefficiency of today that continued, we can look at the right at the outset of the Arab League. It is an organization that was formed in 1945 of the Arab countries that were established. But it's important to note, in order to understand the Arab reality now as well, is that the Arab League was actually an initiative of Britain that was colonizing Palestine, that was colonizing what was then Transjordan and Iraq and had its influences in Lebanon and Syria as well with the French. So it is sort of similar to the Organization of American States that exists today, whose headquarters are in Washington, D.C., in order to prevent any sort of Bolivarian or pan-Latin Americanism to take place in Latin America. And Britain, right from the offset, thought that by forming the Arab League, they can monitor any sort of collaboration that take place between the Arab countries. I'm talking about 1945, about World War II, and of course it was when the Britain needed the Arab countries, and at the same time to prevent any pan-Arabist project. Also in 1950, after the creation of the State of Israel, the Arab League endorsed a more elaborated recommendations of boycott on all Israeli commodities, as well as boycott on all countries or companies who dealt with or invested in Israel. Now, since the 1970s and 1980s, the culmination of the decline of the effectiveness of these boycott policies are manifested in the peace treaties between Israel and Arab states, namely Egypt, which the peace treaty with Egypt was signed in 1979 with President back then Anwar Sadat, and with Jordan, which was signed in 1994. These peace treaties were signed in isolation from the civil society institutions, and they also marked the absence of any regional unity or any united Arab policy between Arab states towards Israel. So both Jordan and Egypt, at the moment when they signed the peace treaties with Israel, there was no collaboration whatsoever with the other Arab countries. It was unilateral, did I say it right? Unilateral step, and without any sort of coordination. And the second sign of this culmination of the decline of the effectiveness is, of course, the Declaration of Principles, which is now commonly known as the Oslo Accords, which were signed by the PLO and Israel in 1993 in Washington, D.C. And these accords as well were done in complete isolation from the Arab countries, in complete separation from the Palestinians. They were done secretly. Palestinians did not, while the PLO was negotiating with Israel in Oslo, the Palestinians were not aware of this at all. So these are the signs of the declines that have taken place in the Arab world. Now, in this context, we can look at the current BDS campaign and the challenging that we face, and this is how we can conceptualize these challenges and this campaign. Given the ineffectiveness of the Arab governments, which coincides with their complicity with the Israeli colonization, whenever we exert pressure, as whether it's the Boycott National Committee in Palestine and other people are involved, the organization involved in the boycott campaign, whenever we exert pressure, on official bodies to boycott Israel, we always find ourselves mainly approaching so-called Western governments and bodies. However, this might be a testimony of sort of the negative stage that we are in, but at the same time, it is very important due to how the state of Israel expresses itself and how it wishes to situate itself in the world. And Israel, of course, wishes to situate itself as a so-called Western civilized and liberal democracy. For instance, one of the current Israeli Minister of Security, Ehud Barak, he once said, "Israel is a villa in the middle of a jungle." We can deal with that later when we speak about the cultural boycott. But just by self-conceiving yourself as a villa, conceptualizing yourself as someone, as a Western country in the midst of barbarians and savages. Another element is that the BDS campaign, which is a global campaign, given how globalized the conflict is and how globalized Israel is, it consists of grassroots initiatives all around the world, including the Arab world, that are answering the Palestinian civil society authoritative call for boycott as a legitimate and nonviolent method to combat the Israeli Zionism. Now, in order to understand the grassroots nature of the global BDS campaign, I think it will be useful to, if you draw a comparison between the US and Israeli-led call to impose sanctions on the government, actually the people of Iran, with the BDS campaign. While according to the policies of the international law and of the United Nations, Israel is of course violating much more resolutions and much more of the international law than Iran ever did. So while the US, while the governments of the United States and Israel are mobilizing the governments of the world to impose sanctions on Iran through lies, hypocrisy, and excess of power, we can look at the grassroots initiative occurring in part of the global BDS campaign. And one big example is the Israel Apartheid Week right here. We of course have the Canadian Union of Postal Workers, we have Quiz undermining Israeli terrorism, we have a group like Tadamon that works with Student Federation, the Teachers Federation. So these are the main characteristics of the BDS campaign. In comparison with a campaign that is based on lies and hypocrisy as the one that is being waged right now against Iran. And I think another gesture of solidarity that have taken place here in Canada and it's worth mentioning is that of Jewish groups and how Jewish groups act here in Canada. I think in comparison with other countries in the so-called West, Canada is very special in the sense, and that's what we hear most about back in Palestine, is the actual Jewish groups and how they are active here in Canada and how they are undermining the basic postulates and the basic elements of the creation of the State of Israel. When Israel claims to be the representatives of Jews all around the world, to claim to be the protector of Jews so that another Holocaust will not ever happen to the Jews in the world, I think just by a small symbolic act of taking over, it's not a small act, but taking over the Israeli consulate in Toronto and here in Montreal by Jewish Canadians is something that really undermines the basics of the Israeli state and of the Israeli apartheid state. No, thank you. Now, if you look at the Israeli state from afar, it is very easy to assume that such acts are small and symbolic and cannot really gravely affect the Israeli economy. However, the colonization of Palestine, since its very beginning, has proven to form a context in which words and symbols become positions more dramatically than in any other conflicts in the world. Boycotting Israel should be understood in the context of the worldwide attention paid to Israel and Palestine, despite that the region is quite small, and the inhabitants number more than 0.2% of the world's population. We must admit that the immense interest that we enjoy from the media and international diplomats seems disproportionately large when one considers the size of the region, as well as the fact that the area neither extremely wealthy nor extremely poor, and contains no resources of crucial importance to the world economy. Here I would like to quote one of the Palestinian intellectuals who passed away recently, Shafiq Al-Hut, who was a representative of the PLO in Lebanon. And one of the things that he said in an interview, the fact that Israel is our enemy is a blessing and a curse at the same time. If it were not for Israel, most people in the Western world probably wouldn't have even heard about us Palestinians. And I think this is very, very, very true, unfortunately. So we are therefore dealing with a symbolic space in which the colonizing power portrays and justifies itself as the defender and protector of Jews all around the world by exploiting the Holocaust and the notion of so-called anti-Semitism as a moral blackmail. And then it portrays itself as a Western democratic and liberal state that is situated on the forefront of the so-called clash of civilizations and what is now called the war on terrorism. And back to the quote of Ehud Barak, that Israel is a villa in the middle of a jungle. And this sort of crazy mentality of being a villa in the middle of a jungle, meaning that you can only protect yourself from the wild animals that surround you by building more walls and by weapons of mass destruction, which is exactly what is taking place right now. And to remind you that while people are talking about imposing sanctions on Iran because of possibly having nuclear weapons in the future, with the nuclear plans, Israel right now has an unknown number of nuclear bombs and nuclear weapons and nuclear capacity, which is even illegal to discuss in the Israeli parliament. Just to remind you about the case of Mordechai Vanunu, who was an Israeli, used to work at the Israeli nuclear plant in Dimona. He was recently released from prison after serving, I think, 30 years in solitary confinement. And to this day, while he is free, in quotes, and he is living in Jerusalem, he is not allowed to speak to any foreigners or to any Palestinians. It's sometimes feel surreal when I walk in Jerusalem. Sometimes you see him sitting at some Arab cafes and everything. You just see him sitting by himself. And even recently, the Israeli intelligence invaded his house, I think, or somewhere where he was with his Norwegian girlfriend, because it's illegal for him to talk to any foreigner. So it is this secrecy that we are talking about with Israel. While actually Iran and Iraq, before the criminal war that was waged on Iraq by the United States and the United Kingdom, people from the international agency of the International Nuclear Agency were allowed to enter the state, while in Israel nobody is allowed to enter, and we're not allowed to have any public debate whatsoever about Israel's nuclear policy. Now, along the same line of thought, Israel has turned out to be not economically omnipotent either, and in fact depends on many external means of support. From the very beginning, foreign donations, compensations, and aid have been some of the most important building blocks of the fledgling Zionist colonies in Palestine, and these enable Israel today to continue and compare itself with high-income countries in Western Europe and in North America. Israel's sources of economic support are directly related to the ways in which it seeks to portray itself around the world, which I've discussed above, as a global protector of Jews, as a villain in the middle of the jungle, and etc. And if we talk about the main resources of the economic resources of Israel, we are first talking about aid from Jewish communities worldwide, since Israel still considers itself to be the protector of all Jews and representative of all Jews. We are talking about aid from the United States, the United States government, and it's mainly military aid. And this is, of course, due to the role that Israel has in the region and the exploitation of the cheap flesh that the United States has of Israelis who are there to any wars that the United States wishes to wage in the region and in the role Israel can have in the region. And the third element of Israeli income is repartition payments of the Holocaust, and a large proportion of which is appropriated by the state rather than disturbed to the actual victims and their families. To this day, Israel keeps receiving compensations, whether from Germany and other organizations and governments, as being the representative of the Jewish people worldwide. Now, one of the main questions that arise when one discusses boycott is whether the boycott is of Israel as an occupier of the West Bank and Gaza Strip, which were occupied in 1967, or if you're boycotting Israel as a state and as a whole. It is very easy to justify the first kind of boycott, which is boycotting settlement products from the territories of 1967. And you can either find even find people like Gordon Brown, the Prime Minister of Britain, who actually requested Israel to label all settlement products and to stop mentioning, to stop labeling them as made in Israel products. Now, what we actually call for, of course, is the complete boycott of Israel. The occupation is not a random onslaught of power, and it isn't conducted on some remote soil. It is a strategic, consistent, deliberate, historically constructed, and externally condoned, and internally sustained attempt to separate Palestinian and Israel rights and lives in the very place where we have always made our home. The conflict did not begin in 1967, and this should be very clear. The Israeli occupation of Palestine was not in 1967. The basics of the Israeli colonization have taken place in 1948, and even before that, with the beginning of Zionist colonization under British auspices in Mandate Palestine. For example, when we all those divisions that people try to divide us by Palestinians who are citizens of the State of Israel, Palestinians in the West Bank, Palestinians in Gaza. It is important to acknowledge right from the beginning that all these components are arbitrary. I spoke about it earlier today in the radio show, if anyone listened to it, that my parents were born inside Israel in 1949, which means 1 year after the creation of the State of Israel. The fact that they were born there and not in a refugee camp in Lebanon or in the Gaza Strip or in Jordan or in the West Bank is purely arbitrary. Those who did manage to remain in Israel after the creation of the State of Israel, those who were forced to go to refugee camps elsewhere, it was pure coincidence. It wasn't anything that got to do with actually Israeli ethical policies or it was mainly due to Israeli military plans back then, the Zionist military plans back then. If you talk about the Galilee, for example, Israel had reached an agreement early enough with the Jordanian government and the Jordanian king back then, King Abdullah, who is the great-grandfather of the current King Abdullah of Jordan. So by being complicit by the Jordanians being complicit with the Zionists and managing to sign a treaty, there were no major battles that took place in the Galilee, which is where my family is originally from. And just because of this fact, we did not become refugees. We actually remained in our land to this day. And one of the other reasons that we do support complete boycott of the State of Israel is that Israeli colonial policies are not restricted to the territories that were occupied in 1967. We as indigenous people of Palestine, as Palestinians inside Israel who hold Israeli citizenship, we, since the creation of the State of Israel, have been suffering a systematic colonial policy to divide us into tribes and religion and different political parties to prevent any sort of national Palestinian organizing against the Israeli state. And this was due because Israel portrays us as enemies, as foreigners in our own land. And these policies are not only in the West Bank and the Gaza Strip. They can be manifested through the education system. They can be manifested through the work of the intelligence. They can be manifested through land appropriations. And land, of course, is a major issue here. The Keren Kayemet, which was before Keren HaYesod, during the Zionist colonization of Palestine before 1948, it's so-called a private organization, but it still works under Israeli law in Palestine. And what it basically does, buying lands from Jews or from Arabs, and once they buy them, according to Israeli law, they are only allowed to sell them to Jews and to let Jews use them, and Arabs are not allowed to use them at all. And then before I finish, just to be able to also speak about Jerusalem and what is today known as East Jerusalem. So Israel, the colonial policies of Israel are even also extended to the parts that they have annexed from the occupied territories of 1967, namely East Jerusalem. When we think of East Jerusalem today, I mainly refer to the municipal boundaries of the Israeli Jerusalem municipality, which have annexed parts of the West, of Jerusalem itself and of the West Bank. So the limits of Jerusalem today, according to Israel, are not the same limits that have existed according to Jordanian law before 1967, when Jerusalem was under Jordanian rule. And so Israel, in fact, has created East, what is today known as East Jerusalem. And East Jerusalem today is a very symbolic space that we can look at when we study or look at Israeli policies regarding Palestinians. What we hear about in the news today about East Jerusalem is only the surface, only the visible iceberg of Israeli colonial policies, whether we're talking about land confiscation, about house demolitions, about the closure of major Palestinian organizations in Jerusalem to prevent any Palestinian organizing in Jerusalem. But under the surface, you have the work of the Israeli intelligence, which, like we as AIC, we have a lot of partners in East Jerusalem. And whether it is us as an organization that works in Jerusalem or whether our partners who actually suffer more than us for being a purely Palestinian organization who work in East Jerusalem, they suffer from the oppression of the Israeli intelligence on a daily basis. This is not something that you will hear about in the media. It's not something that people can easily talk about in the media, but it's very important for people to know how psychologically the Israeli mechanism work. And by that, I mean people in civil clothes all of a sudden showing up to your organization's office, arbitrarily taking pictures, asking for phone numbers, threatening you if you are a woman. And for instance, they have their own agents everywhere. So they know, for instance, if a woman, just to give one example, if a woman is having a relationship with another person and they're not married, so this is, and given that our society is very traditional, they would go to someone and tell her, we will tell your parents and the rest of your family that you have a relationship with another person and unless you collaborate with us. This is one thing. Another thing is that they use the blackmail of drugs, that we are going to plant marijuana leaves in your house and the police is going to raid your house or the office. And this is just to prove that you are a drug addict or whatever. So it is, I think we have reached a situation today in Palestine where it is not only what we see, what is happening. It's not only the house demolition. It's not only the land confiscation. Israel has developed a very sophisticated and smart mechanism to control the Palestinians and to create a culture of fear among Palestinians, to try to prevent any action from taking place before it's actually about to take place. And I chose to speak about this today because this is something that that many people are suffering from right now, and many of the organizations are suffering from. And it is very important to take it into account by trying to understand the complexity of the situation today. So I think I will stop here. I went too far. So thank you very much.